Okay, so we're second week of this new series on understanding and engaging the world. And these first 2 weeks, so last week and this week, are about understanding the world around us. We said last week that the overall purpose of the 6 weeks is going to be to understand the world so that we can both protect ourselves from becoming worldly. So last week we looked at those verses about being in the world but not of it. So protect ourselves from becoming worldly, but also work out how we can best engage the world around us, talk to them, given that we all find evangelism difficult. Dave, any chance you could nip and ask them to turn the music down? Is that right? Thanks. Probably down. If you get bored halfway, you can go back and tell them to turn it up. But, so just a very brief recap of last week there, just for those of you who weren't here, we looked at what's the Bible's view of non-Christian? How does a non-Christian think and operate and work? And we saw four big things. First of all, everybody, Christian or not, continues to know God personally. So even if you're Richard Dawkins, you know God. Romans 1 tells us that he knows God. He suppresses it, he denies it, but he knows God. And the real God as well, not just some vague idea about God. He knows the real God. The second thing we saw was that it's impossible for human beings not to worship and serve something, some God. So if they suppress the real God, push God of the Bible out of the way, they just replace him with something else. So replace him with Allah, or replace him with materialism, or sex, or money, or whatever it is. You have to worship and serve some God. Those two are about belief. So you know God on the one hand, while suppressing him, and then try and swap him for a false God. But the second 2 points there, we also know, everybody knows, non-Christians know, how we're meant to live. Okay, everybody knows how we're meant to live, right from wrong. But although we know how we're meant to live, non-Christians know that when they live their non-Christian life, they're doing wrong. Okay, they know they're doing wrong. So what they do is they associate with other people who are in the same situation, and they approve of others, you know, who are also living wrongly. There's a verse we read. I've put it somewhere on the sheet. It's 1:32. Talking about non-Christians, though they know God's decree, that is how we should live, that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. So they don't even only do wrong, they egg everybody else on into a sort of big society of rebellion. So if that's the sort of the one non-Christian's life story, if you like, what's going on in a non-Christian's head, what we're going to do this week in terms of understanding the world is think how that plays out on a bit of a bigger scale, and think a bit about the idea of idolatry in the Bible. And there's only two major points really this evening. The first one is that idols preach to us. Okay, down on the sheet there, idols preach to us. There's been, if you listen to the sort of sermons on the internet or read internet Christian blogs or whatever, there's been a massive resurgence in the last 5 years or so, maybe 10 years, about talking about idolatry. When I was at university, hardly even thought about it. Never heard a sermon on it. Suddenly, it's absolutely everywhere. Everybody's talking about idolatry, which is good because it's a biblical concept and it's a major biblical concept. But like anything, when suddenly everybody's talking about something, you can almost numb yourself to it because you get so used to it. It sort of loses its edge, or it loses its ability to get under your skin. I remember talking to one person a good while ago now, but about how they were idolising relationships. And I was talking to them, and it just wasn't getting anywhere, because they were sort of saying, well, yeah, I probably do, but so what? I mean, who cares? How do I do anything about it? I don't. You know, it was just washing off them, because they'd heard it so many times. They were able just to say, yeah, I've got a problem with idolatry. And you know. So what we're going to do this evening, really, is try and take that concept of idolatry a bit further. And the key thing for this first point is that just as you've got a real God who has a real gospel, a message that he preaches to us, the good news of Christ, so idols, false gods, have false gospels, false messages that go with them. An idol, from Romans 1 again last week, it wants us to serve it and to worship it, these false idols. And so they call us to them. Idols call us to them. And it's the reverse of the gospel. So whereas in the gospel, Christ comes to us and says, stop serving an idol, so stop serving Allah and turn to Christ. When idols call us, so perhaps let's take money as an example. Money calls to us and says, stop, if you're a Christian, stop serving Christ and live for your wealth, live for money. So fleshing that one out, the third paragraph down there on the sheet, the idol says to the Christian, if it's the idol of wealth, stop doing all the Christian stuff. So stop sharing, stop giving your money generously to church or to those in need. Stop believing the lie that it's more blessed to give than receive. Remember those are Jesus' words. Repent. Instead, see that by spending your money on yourself, you'll be happy. You'll be secure if you spend it on yourself or store it up. That's the right thing to do. Trust me. So it's saying repent and believe, just as the real gospel says it, but it's repent from following Christ and turn and trust the idol. Same concepts, different sort of gods in the two gaps. And we are constantly, if you live in the real world, you are constantly being bombarded by this kind of teaching, by this kind of evangelism, effectively. These gospels are being thrown at you all the time, inescapably. Now, the fact is that only God can create out of nothing. Okay, human beings can't do that, can they? You know, we can't just bring something to be. Satan can't do that. False gods can't do that. And in the Bible, I should say that although idols are seen as nothing, so when you take a literal idol, like a lump of wood that someone carves into a god, obviously it's just a lump of wood. Paul, particularly in 1 Corinthians 10 and elsewhere, associates them with demons. So although the idol itself is just a lump of wood, Paul always sees the shadowy hand of Satan behind. So I'll use the two interchangeably. So Satan himself can't create out of nothing. Okay, he can't give you new things that don't exist in the universe. So what he does is he takes good things and that God made and corrupts them. So very obviously, sex is a good gift for marriage between men and female. What does Satan do? Well, he takes a good gift. He can't create anything new. He didn't create sex, but he takes it and sort of mucks it around and gives it to you in the wrong way. You know, sleep with who you want, whatever. But he's using God's stuff. He can only use God's stuff because he can't make anything new. And similarly, when he comes to try and evangelize you with his false gospels, these idolatrous gospels or demonic gospels, he uses the same technique, if you like, the same... brilliant. The same gospel categories are there. He just fills them with slightly different content. We'll turn over the page and we'll try and flesh this out into, real-life examples, as it were. One of the best passages I know on this, 2 Kings... chapter 18. If you want to look that up, 2 Kings 18. And then we'll read it. Someone else can read it though, so you don't have to listen to me. 2 Kings 18, 19 to 35. Whilst you find that, I'll just explain the situation. What's going on here? Kings is one of the story books telling the story of the people of Israel. And we're towards the end of the story, so pretty near the end of the Old Testament in terms of the timeline. And there's a good king, or a goodish king, Hezekiah, who's king of Judah, where Jerusalem is the capital. And he is at war with Assyria. Okay, Assyria have come and they're besieging Jerusalem. And there's this guy called the Rabshakeh, who's a vizier, or like the high official. He's like the second in charge after the sort of emperor of Assyria. And the Rabshakeh, or the vizier, depends what translation you've got, is the commander of the forces. So as this passage begins, the commander of the attacking Assyrians, the bad guys, are outside the gates of Jerusalem with a huge army, and all the poor Israelites are cooped up inside Jerusalem, worried that they're about to get butchered. So, can someone with a decently loud voice read chapter 18, verses 19 to 35?
I've got a loud voice, but I'm not necessarily the best reader, but I'm happy to do it.
Give it a shot.
The field commander said to them, "Tell Hezekiah, this is what the great king, the king of Assyria, says. On what are you basing this confidence of yours? You say you have strategy and military strength, but you speak only empty words. On whom are you depending? You rebel against me. Look now, you are depending on Egypt, that splintered reed of a staff, which pierces a man's hand and wounds him if he leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who depend on him. And if you say to me, we are depending on the Lord our God, isn't he the one whose high places and altars Hezekiah removed, saying to Judah and Jerusalem, you must worship before this altar in Jerusalem. Come now, make a bargain with my master, the king of Assyria. I will give you 2,000 horses, if you can put riders on them. How can you repulse one officer of the least of my master's officials, even though you are depending on Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Furthermore, have I come to attack and destroy this place without word from the Lord? The Lord himself told me to march against this country and destroy it. Does anyone else want to take over?
I'll read.
Thanks, sir.
Then Eliakim, Shebna, and Joah told the official, speak Aramaic to us, sir. We understand it. Don't speak Hebrew. All the people on the wall are listening. He replied, do you think you and the king are the only ones the emperor sent me to say all these things to? No, I am also talking to the people who are sitting on the wall, who will have to eat their excrement and drink their urine, just as you will. Then the official stood up and shouted in Hebrew, listen to what the emperor of Assyria is telling you. He warns you not to let Hezekiah deceive you. Hezekiah can't save you. And don't let him persuade you to rely on the Lord. Don't think that the Lord will save you and that he will stop our Assyrian army from capturing your city. Don't listen to Hezekiah. The emperor of Assyria commands you to come out of the city and surrender. You will all be allowed to eat grapes from your own vines and figs from your own trees and to drink water from your own wells until the emperor resettles you in a country much like your own, where there are vineyards to give wine, there is corn for making bread. It is a land of olives, olive oil, and honey. If you do what he commands, you will not die, but live. Don't let Hezekiah fool you into thinking that the Lord will rescue you. Did the gods of any other nations save their countries from the emperor of Assyria? Where are they now, the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of...
Funny places.
Yeah, Henna and Iva. Did anyone save Samaria? When did any of the gods of all these countries ever save their country from the emperor? Then what makes you think the Lord can save Jerusalem?
Thanks. Bailed just in time, Ollie. Wise. Okay, long passage, but we'll pick it apart bit by bit. What you've got here is the official, or the guys, Rabshakeh, or the vizier, is preaching to the people inside the city. And his big aim is to get them to abandon God, the Lord, or Yahweh, and Hezekiah, God's king, God's anointed king, and turn instead to serve the Assyrian king and come and follow the Assyrian gods. So he is he's doing a very obvious bit, essentially, of evangelism, reverse evangelism. Stop being a proper Jew, start being an Assyrian. We're going to look at how he does it, because it's a bit of an insight into how these idols come and attack us. So just two sort of sub-points here. The first thing is that idols copy the story of God's gospel. Okay, they copy the story of God's gospel. If you have been a Christian any amount of time, you'll know that basically the gospel is a story, isn't it? It begins with creation. It then all goes wrong with the fall, where we sin. Then, okay, a bit of complication in between, but basically God sends Christ to come and rescue us, salvation. And then he promises us a great future if we trust Christ, and threatens us with an awful future if we reject Christ. So those four staging points, the past, where God made us in the beginning, the second, where we rebelled, the third, where he comes to save us, and the fourth, where basically we have the choice of the future, heaven or hell, is the basic story of the gospel. And what this official does, this commander does, is parrot or parody or counterfeit those same categories. So for a Jew sat inside the walls or standing on the walls, trying to work out whether he should defect and give in to Assyria, or whether he should stand and fight. The message the Assyrian brings goes something like this. Well, there's a beginning to it. So the whole story, as it were, of this Assyrian's gospel begins when the Assyrians come to power. They haven't been around forever, but the Assyrians have come to power. And earlier on, sort of verses 17 and 18, and a bit earlier in the book, it talks about how the Assyrians have grown into a mighty empire and they've conquered all sorts of other people. 100 years earlier, Jews don't have to care about Assyria. They're just a tiny, poxy little country in the north. Now the Assyrians are the big force. So it's the beginning of the story. The Assyrians are around and they've come to the gates of Jerusalem. And so what message does the Assyrian commander preach? What they need to do, the worst thing you could do, the stupidest mistake you could make, Judaites, in Jerusalem, okay, the what not to do, the sin that you'll commit, is if you disobey me in Assyria. Okay, that's the worst thing to do. Trusting Hezekiah and your stupid lord, Yahweh, instead of trusting me and the king of Assyria. That's sin. That's stupid. That's what's going to kill you. What not to do. How can you be saved? Verse 31, for instance. Don't listen to Hezekiah, but instead make your peace with the king of Assyria and come out to him. So the only way you're going to be saved from disaster is by coming to serve, live for, accept blessing from the king of Assyria. And then there's a future as well. If you do that, verse 32, what will happen? Or 31 and 32. Each one of you will eat of his own vine, each one of his own fig tree. Each one of you will drink water from his own system until I come and take you away to a land like your own land of grain and wine, of bread and vineyards, olive trees and honey, that you may live. What's that language reminiscent of? Where have we heard that language before? Earlier in the Bible? Promised land. It's an exact mimicking of exactly what God promised them. Back in Deuteronomy, did I put it on the sheet? No, it's in Deuteronomy 8, I don't think I wrote it down. God says to the people, if you obey me and serve me, I will take you into a land flowing with milk and honey. You know, each of you will be under your own fig tree, under your own vine, drinking your own water. What does the Assyrian say? No, trust me and I will take you into a land. He's saying, I'll take you to Assyria, basically. I'll move you off into a new land. So he's promising a kind of heaven for them. And if they disobey, well, they're going to get massacred. Verse 32, you're going to die. Verse 27, you know, you're doomed to eat dung and drink your own urine, basically until we annihilate you, just like we've annihilated every other city. So the same categories are there. The beginning of the story when the Assyrians arrive, the sin, the worst thing you can do, disobey the Assyrians. The best thing you can do, come to the Assyrians for salvation, and the promise of blessing if you do, the threat of judgment if you don't. It's the same gospel categories, but just with Yahweh, or the God of the Bible, shunted out, and the God of Assyria put in. And actually, that's what all idolatrous gospels do to us. I put a little grid down there. You can think of them in this way. So, trying to take a sort of fairly simple example, I mentioned earlier that the person who was struggling with romance and was just idolising romance. The way that gospel story works is that, well, for a girl, it all begins when they meet the dream guy. Okay, they're single, they're at school in the class, and the new guy arrives in class, the perfect guy for them that they're madly in love with. The worst thing they can do, the sort of sin they can commit against this new god, this idol, would be upsetting him or offending him or letting him down in some way, disappointing him. The thing that will save you, that make your life worthwhile, is if he came and asked you out. Heaven would be ending up with him forevermore, walking off into the sunset. Hell would be being single or being dumped or being left alone, chucked or not even looked at. That's a very, I suppose, fairly simple one, but you'll either know it from your own experience or you'll know it if you sort of know teenagers now. It's massively powerful, isn't it? Poor guys and girls who just, life is not worthwhile unless I'm with someone. I can't be happy unless I've got someone. What they're doing is they're having a look, not just worshipping a false god of romance, they're creating a false heaven, going out with someone. And they're singing as the worst thing in the world. Well, singleness, that'll be hell. Similarly, children. You can make children into your idol in all sorts of ways. But if the particular way you idolize your children is this massive demand for them to love you. Okay, that's what makes your life worthwhile. That's your idol. Well, it all begins, presumably, when you have a child. The way you sin against your children and having them love you would be to upset them. The way to find salvation is to make them happy, maybe buy them things or give them gifts or let them have what they want. Always let them have their own way. Heaven is when they sort of look into your eyes and hug you and tell you that you're the best dad ever. Hell is maybe if they stop talking to you or there's a family bust up. We'll come back to those blank boxes, but just at the bottom there on the sheet before we stop for some discussion. The thing about this is twofold. One is that this is helping us hopefully identify how these gospels evangelize us, these idols evangelize us. But it's also the case, remember from Romans 1, that it's what we worship motivates our behavior, because we worship and serve these gods. Okay, the idol controls our behavior. And it's because we believe a lie, believe in a false god, that we displease and disobey the real God. So the girl in that romance example, whose main idol, okay, is to get a guy, will be prepared to disobey God if it means getting the guy, because the idol trumps God. So where there's a clash, where God and romance go head to head, well, romance is going to win. I'm prepared to disobey God in order to get a guy. But why is she prepared to do that? Well, because she's believed not just the lie that romance is God, but only romance can make her happy, heaven. And if she doesn't get it, it's going to be hell on earth. And therefore, her conclusion is, it's better to displease God, to disobey God, than it is to be single. If I've got to choose, I'll displease God, disobey God. Just stop there. Any questions on that so far? I'm slightly galloping. The categories. I'm going to get you to fill in the blanks on some of these things, which might promote more, but on the way that the gospels mimic the story, sorry, idols mimic the story of the gospel. Does that kind of make sense? Utterly confusing. Okay, great. Have a crack. There's no one right answer to each of these boxes, but try and sort of fill in the blanks in some of these boxes or make up your own. Don't worry if you can't fill every box for everyone, and like I said, there's different ways these things could become idols, but try and think through what someone's life would look like who idolised career. Sort of myself, just running my own life. I mean, the kind of person who always puts me first. You know, my time when I want it, my space when I need it, me, or money. Try and fill in those categories. And if you like, make up your own one if you get time. Getting it, as it were, as I would fill in the gaps. Okay. Okay, here's a question, group question. If you look at, say, the kids one, having children, good thing. Upsetting your kids, not necessarily a bad thing. And being upset that your kids are upset, fine, usually. It's good to make your kids happy. It's great when your kids tell you they love you. It's understandably upsetting when they separate from you. So how do you know when you're idolising one of these things rather than just understandably, you know, having it affect you? When do you know you're idolising your kids' affection or romance or money? Because basically everything in that list is a perfectly good thing, apart from selfishness, obviously. But all the rest of them are decent things. When you put them before God, yep. And how would you sort of know that you're putting them before God? Okay, that's a good one. Yeah. That I think that's huge, actually. It becomes, Becky's words, sense of identity or purpose. So it sort of becomes in your head almost the controlling story of your life. If you're honest, it's what you think about most, what you sort of scheme about most, dream about most. It's the first thing you think about yourself, you know, yeah. What other clues would there might be that they've got above God? Yeah, your emotions are often the biggest giveaway, I think, tied in with Becky Singh, really. But if in fact, the guy who's my best man at the wedding, I don't think he listens to these. sorry, Tim. If so, yeah. We saw him in London the other week, and he the way he works in graduate recruitment, he gets paid a basic salary, and then he gets paid a massive part of his earning, basically his bonus, depending on how well he's done. And last year he worked really well, got loads of bonus, invested it and lost it all. So he put it in the stocks and shares, went on a Christian summer camp where there was no phone reception because it was in the middle of back end and beyond. 10 days without phone reception. On the first day of the camp, little known to him, you know, all the stockbrokers, whatever, were saying this company's had it, bail. He had no idea. 10 days later, comes out of camp and he's just lost all his money, you know, almost all his year's earnings. Now, that's gutting. Everybody's going to be upset if that happens to them. He took it remarkably well. You know, he was able to handle it. And I think one of the reasons he's able to handle it, you know, it was a big hit on him financially, but one of the reasons he's able to handle it is because he's got secure faith in God. And much as he'd preferred for that money to have made money and come back, or at least stayed the same, it wasn't the biggest thing in his life. So it was a blow, and it was suffering, and he'd been upset, no doubt, and annoyed, and all the rest of it, but it didn't get out of proportion. And it's that your emotions let you know when you've got things out of proportion. If you basically think, I can't be happy unless I'm married, or I can't be happy unless I have kids, can't be happy unless I progress in my career, if I win my sports match, if I have complete control of all my property and stuff, I just can't be happy. Or equally, if you're utterly devastated when it goes wrong, when the sort of hell situation arrives, that's often a clue that it's got way out of hand in your life. And you'll know what things really annoy you, wind you up way beyond what they should do, or terrify you, and those are the clues. And also what things make you inordinately happy. It should be that the thought of getting to know Christ better, or seeing Christ face to face in the future, is what gets us out of bed in the morning. The first thing that gets us out of bed in the morning. For most of us, it isn't. It's something else. So emotions, dreams, those sort of things that are a giveaway. The other thing, which is really off the back of what Wendy said, is when there's a clash. So the sort of person who's, idolises leisure. When it's a clash, I know I ought to go to church. Church meets, you know, once a Sunday. I know I ought to be there, but I'd rather watch TV. You've got a clear right, wrong. If you go with the, you know, sit at home and watch TV, you know that the idol's got you. It's trumped God. When it's head-to-head between God and the idol, if the idol wins, well, you know it's got out of hand. A good desire's got out of hand. So a big thing there really is that it's just the copying of the story, the gospel message, the four boxes of the gospel, if you sort of learn two ways to live, or two ways to live's got six, actually, hasn't it? But idols do the same. Oh. We'll get there. Yeah, possibly next week. no, good question. Yeah. We're getting there. So they copy the story of the gospel much more quickly, really. They also, this is a sort of subtle point, but they also copy, idols copy the strategy of God's gospel. So far we've looked at the content of the message. Promising you heaven, threatening you with hell, saying this is the way to be saved, this is the way to end up in hell. But no less important, really, is the way they talk to us. If you just look at the way this guy, I've lost the passage now, in 18 talks, and you can find examples of this all the way through the Bible, how people speak to Jesus and treat Jesus when he's trying to preach the true gospel, how people treat Paul, all sorts of examples. It's just that this one passage happens to have a lot of them in, so it makes it easier. So how does he speak? Well, verse 23 and 24, as he shouts in, come now, make a wager with my master. I'll give you 2,000 horses if you're able to, on your part, to set riders on them. He's mocking them. Come on, you know, come and have a fight. Tell you what, we'll give you 2,000 horses on your side. He's just rubbishing them, mocking them. The little passage between 26 and 28, when the Jews, the leaders of the Jews, those three guys with difficult names, say, please speak to us in Aramaic. We understand Aramaic, that's your Assyrian language. Don't speak to us in Hebrew. Because if you shout at us in Hebrew, everyone in the city will understand and get scared. And the guy says, that's why I'm speaking in Hebrew. What's he doing? He's using the tactic of making sure he's really reaching people, communicating with, you know, with all his ability to make sure as many people as possible hear his false gospel. He could have talked in Aramaic, his natural language, his native language, sorry, but he translates it deliberately to make it as easy as possible for all these Jews to understand that the false message he's shouting. He threatens them. Seen that all over the place. Well, you're doomed to eat your own dung and drink your own urine. That's a pretty grim threat. Or a bit later, you're just going to die. He tries to undermine the opposition. So verse 29. Thus says the king of Assyria, don't let Hezekiah, that's their king, the good king, deceive you, for he won't be able to deliver you out of your hand. Do not let Hezekiah make you trust the Lord by saying the Lord will deliver you. He's sort of undermining the truth, the attacking the truth, telling the Jews that, no, you're being deceived by the one you're following at the moment. And he even uses evidence later on, so verse 33 onwards. You know, has any of the other gods managed to defeat us? Where are the gods of X, Y, and Z? You know, they've just, look, we've whipped everybody else. Hey, just look at the facts. The facts tell you that our God, the king of Assyria, is going to win, not your stupid Yahweh, who, let's face it, hasn't done very well defending anyone else. Neither has any other god. So he sort of appeals to evidence, uses argument. And actually, well, this is going to be the next exercise, so I won't tell you exactly how, but those are the same kind of tactics that God uses in pushing the gospel on, or preaching the gospel to us as, when we're not Christians. So again, just next little discussion. For each of those tactics, or maybe just pick two so you don't run out of time, mocking and threatening or something, try and think of an example of how that strategy, that tactic, is used against Christianity today. Okay, think of an example of how it's used against us today. Perhaps you've suffered it. Try and think of an example of somewhere in the Bible where God uses it positively to attack idolatry, obviously, rather than to attack Christianity. And in fact, just do A and B. That's probably easier. Just do an A and B. So pick a couple of those things, and how do we see those things in action today against us and in the Bible for us? In 2 Corinthians, Paul's early chapter 2 Corinthians, Paul's dealing with gospel ministry. 2 Corinthians 2:11, he talks about how he says we are not unaware of Satan's strategies. And that's really what this little bit was about. Just beginning to think through, and of course we've only scratched the surface, but how, if you like, we're attacked as Christians. So very obviously we're mocked. I mean, that's pretty easy, isn't it? You know, made to look stupid on TV, or associated with nut bar Christians who want to burn everybody, or whatever it might be. Satan is a brilliant communicator. Okay? The God delusion that Dawkins got published was ridiculed even by academic atheists. And yet it was a massive seller. But it shouldn't have been, because its quality was actually pretty poor. Even the sort of top atheists thought it was rubbish. And yet, massive seller. And Joe Public laps it up. Brilliant. But if you wrote a Christian book of similar quality, you'd get annihilated, you'd get laughed out of court. I mean, there's points in it where he appeals to sort of, you know, Professor so-and-so says this about the Bible. And then people would go and look up, who is this Professor so-and-so? And he'd be a professor of, you know, mathematics or something, nothing to do with the Bible. He's just been spouting his opinions. And you'd get annihilated if you wrote that as a Christian. Dawkins, yeah, great. Goes worldwide. Massive publisher. Phenomenon. The internet, brilliant. Loads of anti-God stuff out there, as it were. Either explicitly, but this isn't all just about promoting atheism. It's also, you know, the internet is, what is it, 2/3 used for porn or something? I don't know what it is. Just these other things that pull us away. Very obviously we're threatened. If you talk about your faith, if you tell someone else at work that you think they're wrong, so a minister of another church, his wife, very gently and politely said that they couldn't go to a colleague's gay wedding, and were, you know, basically threatened with a sack for being so offensive. I mean, these stories come up all the time. So there's all these different strategies he uses to get us. And interestingly, they're all just borrowed off God. God's always mocking idols in the Bible, for instance. The prophets of Baal, where Elijah says, you know, when he chucks the water on and says, you know, go on then, light the fire, and they can't do it. And eventually he stands there shouting, oh, maybe Baal's gone to the toilet. Should we wait for him to get back? You know, we're mocking. on and on we could go. He certainly threatens, obviously, idols and all sorts. But the big sort of first major point, and by far the main point of this evening, is that these idols preach to us. Idols preach to us. They have gospels. So when you're thinking about idolatry, think not just in terms of what God do I worship, but also what false heavens am I striving for? What false methods of salvation am I using to get there? What false sort of sin and hells am I terrified of? Now, back on the sheets there, because idols preach, the final thing we're looking at tonight is because idols preach, therefore, culture preaches to us too. So that verse from Romans 1:32 again. Though they, so that's people who've rejected God, though they know God's decree that those who practice such evil things deserve to die, they not only do them but give approval to those who practice them. It's not enough for idols and idolaters to exist or for demons to exist. They must also gather around them people who think likewise. Okay, they've got to build a church. They've got to promote their idolatrous worldview, suck other people in. That's Satan's great scheme, after all, the father of lies. But of course, although, as I've said, demons in the Bible's view stand behind idolatry, stand behind the, I don't know, the sort of porn film industry or whatever, idols themselves can't speak. So money has never said to you, hey, you need more of me. Some little sort of success, whatever that might be, hasn't popped up and said, you need me, you need to be successful. It's always people who preach or things that people make, i.e. it's the worshippers of the idol who preach to us. Now, in this Sunday series recently, we've been looking at the cultural mandate, and we've seen that it's God's first command, go and fill the earth, rule it, subdue it. It's about kids and culture, family and work, everything else you produce. And the fact is that all human beings obey that cultural mandate, either in the service of God or in the service of an idol. So you might not be a Christian, but you'll still have family. You might not be a Christian, you might be a Muslim, but you'll still go to work. You'll still write films or books or whatever. You might be a worshipper of money. You'll still obey the cultural mandate, or rather disobey it, as you serve a false god. That means that everything that humans produce, whether that's more humans, family, or everything else, stuff, books, films, magazines, work, houses, cars, everything somehow will preach to us and evangelize us. Everything is made in the service or done in the service of some god. And often we don't notice this. So to take the family example, you grow up accepting pretty much as normal the living standards that you experience as kids. And so subconsciously you come to believe that those are the right standards, the right way to live. So, you know, the house, the kind of house you live in, the kind of house holidays you were taken on, the presents you were given, all subtly sort of tell us this is how life should be. And so when things change, we get stroppy. But actually our beliefs might be far from biblical. And almost more importantly, we pick up our family's values on right and wrong, what's good, what's bad, our morals, our family's attitude to possessions, our family's attitude to sort of private time versus public time, way our families communicate, the way our families treat different groups of people, almost an endless list. We just pick them up subconsciously. And most of the time, we're very slow to reassess those in the light of the Bible. So actually, our family for 18 years, if you like, or 16 years or whatever, has been preaching to us. Just subtly, might not be explicit, and especially if they're not Christian, although even if they are, and no one's perfect, we'll be picking up all these little false messages. And one of the big things is having the discernment to realise that we need to come back constantly and assess it in the light of Scripture. There's some Bob Dylan anniversary at the moment, I've forgotten what it is. He's all, what's it, is it? 70. Is he 70? Right. He's all over the radio anyway. He said this, I think art can lead you to God. I think that's the purpose of everything, in fact. If it's not doing that, what's it doing? It's leading you the other way. It's certainly not leading you nowhere. And he's dead right. Everything preaches to you. Every TV show, magazine, book, person, group, family, somehow it gives you a sort of message. So just final paragraph there. Just as idols have false gospels, they also have false churches, false gatherings of people, and false Bibles, sort of texts and prophets. To promote their message and reaffirm their worshippers. So, later Lady Gaga's song, you know, Born This Way, about how, you know, because I was born like this, it's okay to be gay. She's a prophet, effectively, a spokesperson, promoting the gay rights gospel. Her songs preach that message and have gone worldwide. You get even kids who don't understand what they're singing are just sort of repeating it. Almost like, you know, learn hymns in church or something. And her concerts gather together all sorts of people who, similarly, have the same sort of views. Or a more religious version, obviously, Islam gathers people together in mosques or pilgrimages. It has its authoritative book, the Quran. It has its spokesmen who promote its message, the clerics and imams and co. More subtly, you know, we live in communities where perhaps sort of everybody reads the Telegraph, listens to Radio 4, watches the same TV shows, and respects the same kind of sort of public intellectuals. And so there's immense pressure to think like everybody else around us, or like the people we read and watch. Children go to school where they're taught, and they naturally, because they're young and the teachers are old, respect the teachers, even though the teachers will have ideology. The curriculum certainly has an ideology. And again, it's preach, 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 preach. That second section, therefore, is really just, I suppose, putting the first into real life. The first section says, idols preach to us. The second section, how? Well, through everything. Don't think that the only way you ever get sort of pulled away from the gospel is when someone very explicitly comes and says, why don't you become a Muslim? Or why don't you watch this porn film? Or why don't you steal something from this bank? That's very rarely going to happen. It's much more subtle, these enticements to live the way of the world rather than to live in God's footsteps. So final little discussion there as we finish. Verse from 1 Thessalonians where Paul says to turn from idols to serve the true and living God. Everything we've looked at this evening is about how false idols call you to repent and turn from Christ and have faith and serve true and living idols. So to try and sort of tie the threads together, as you look back at the material this evening and particularly your own life experience, try and share some examples of how you've come under pressure either to abandon completely or just to lessen. Often it's just about dampening down your commitment to Christ. And try and think how that's come about. Is it through family, kids, the family side of things, mum, dad, siblings, whatever? Or is it through culture, the rest of the world around you, whether it's what you read, see, the people you hang around with? And if you get charmed, sort of think about what strategies they use. They try and intimidate you, just charm you, tempt you, promise sort of heaven to you, promise great things if you just calm down a bit. What methods do they use? I think that's probably enough for this evening. The last, very last bit is about how we begin to combat these false gospels. Really, that's the theme of the next couple of weeks. So if you get time, you can think about the last question. But the way this 6 weeks is to work is that these first 2 weeks, if you like, have been the theory, understanding the world. And then the next 2 weeks is going to be about fighting back, combating them, both for our own godliness and for the sort of rescuing of people around us. So the main thing, really, first week is understanding. Any clarifications, either on the questions or the last little section on the way that the world preaches to us? Great. Go for it, and then I suppose in 10 minutes or so, if you want to turn to pray,
I'll pass some prayer sheets around.